Hello, it's Bob. Now, my custom is to end each year with some self-indulgence before I embark on reforms in January. And accordingly, this end-of-the-year podcast is an interview not by me, but of me. It was conducted by Glenn Lowry and posted a couple of days ago on the Glenn Show podcast, and I thought I'd share it with those of you who aren't Glenn Show subscribers. Glenn and I get into a lot of things in this conversation: artificial intelligence, foreign policy, speech codes, the coming Trump administration, the outgoing Biden administration, and other stuff. And as long as it's the end of the year, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for being a non-zero podcast listener. And I especially want to thank those of you who are full-fledged non-zero members, which is to say, paid subscribers to the non-zero newsletter on Substack. Your support helps us keep doing what we're doing, and everybody on the team appreciates it. And of course, we also appreciate it when people rate and or review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice, or smash the YouTube like button, or click the Non-Zero newsletter like button, or in some other way, help spread awareness of Non-Zero and its mission. So we will keep pursuing that mission in 2025, and I will see you then. Thanks again, and enjoy the holidays.
You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Glenn Lowry. You've tuned in or are listening to The Glenn Show. I'm with Robert Wright. Bob is an old friend. He is a founder of bloggingheads.tv and meaningoflife.tv channels. He's creator of the Non-Zero Foundation. He's the author of many books on human culture and behavior and psychology and evolutionary psychology and morality and whatnot. He's a wise man and introduced me to this medium, frankly, through bloggingheads.tv years ago, an old friend and someone I admire. Welcome, Bob. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for using the platform to such great advantage. I do like to claim that I turned you into the video and audio star you are.
Okay. Well, I'm in your debt to that effect. And I'd also like to learn from you, Bob, because you've been around for a while working in journalism, writing about world affairs, and the world seems to be on fire just right now. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what our prospects are getting out of this thing, you know, alive.
Well, yeah, things, I wouldn't say, have gotten more stable lately. Conceivably, they could in the Middle East as a result of what happened in Syria. But by and large, no, my advice would be fasten your seatbelts. I'm actually writing a book about artificial intelligence, and I'm pretty convinced that that will, at least in the near term, be a kind of destabilizing thing, even though it will bring a lot of good things. It's just going to hit fast and take people a while to adapt to, I think. And
is that about the weaponry or what?
Not, I would say for the most part, no. I mean, that is an issue, the literally military uses of it, but there are other kinds of arms races that could be destabilizing, just in the sense of accelerating the rate of progress. There's just so many dimensions of it. I mean, there's the effect on employment. I mean, even if it turns out to provide as many or more jobs than it takes away, that still can be dislocating in the short term for people who have to find a new way to make a living. You know, we're already seeing a couple of lawsuits by parents of this company, Character AI, because their kids got so close to this AI character, and one of them committed suicide, and the parents blame it on the chatbot. In the other case, apparently, well, whatever the details are, but the point is, this is going to be another realm of adjustment when people start developing very close relationships with these things, especially kids. And, you know, we saw what happened with social media when corporations optimize the algorithm for engagement. There is, in principle, the same commercial incentive here to do that. And, you know, these will be more alluring and subtly powerful, I think, even in social media in some ways. And there's a lot of other things. You know, I mean, there's a lot of ways bad actors can put it to use, developing bioweapons. And there's just going to be a lot to adjust to.
Don't I hear this same concern and lament every time there's a technological breakthrough? And what is to be done other than fret and wring our hands? There's no holding it back. No?
Well, I guess my first advice would be when somebody in the AI business complains that something would stifle innovation or something, like if we don't, you know, build enough nuclear reactors immediately to fulfill all our dreams of scaling this stuff up, that'll slow down progress. I would say, first of all, that may be a feature, not a bug. This is going to move plenty fast. Don't worry. And, you know, secondly, I'd say in the long run, I think it's going to take some international governance, some things that nations agree on. And so I worry about the implications of a deeply conflictual relationship with China. You know, and that seems to have been the trend for the most part over the last few years, is things getting more and more tense with China. I think that could be problematic. I mean, these are the two AI superpowers of the US and China. And I think it would be good for the world if they can, you know, talk about this thing and work out some rules of the road.
I was listening to some talking heads on television this weekend. This subject, AI, came up. One of the talking heads was a US senator, although I don't remember which one, who said, we can't let the Chinese win the AI race.
Yeah. Well, that's a common refrain.
I mean, what would it mean? What would it mean to lose the AI race? And, you know, what's the threat that's being imagined here? And what is to be done about it? How do you keep China from winning the AI race, whatever that means?
Glenn, by even asking these questions, you are like on the very cutting edge of discourse. Almost no one involved in the conversation even, you know, asks people to at least flesh out the scenario, right? Like, how exactly does this hurt us? Now, I mean, one concern, I guess, is the military realm, but I really don't think it's the main concern. You know, broadly in discourse about China, there is this assumption that China wants to smother democracy around the world. And there's just no evidence of it. You know, I mean, all the evidence is that we are more intent on spreading our ideology than China is on spreading its. Now, in the first Cold War, it was an explicit aim of the Soviet Union to spread communism, but China seems to be much more pragmatic in its relations. Now, it does feel it's a great power. It's trying to throw around its weight, both regionally and in international institutions. All that's true. That gives us some things to reckon with. That's all true. But I think we have to be as clear-eyed as possible and try to understand what's actually going on in the minds of the leaders, what their actual aspirations are. And in the realm of AI, it's funny. It's turned out that there was this movement toward a kind of a hawkish attitude toward China that's been underway at least since the pandemic. And AI has kind of added to that in the sense that it's given pretty much everyone in Silicon Valley involved in AI an incentive to be a China hawk, because what you just said works so well for them. Like, if you regulate us, China will beat us in AI. And if you don't give us enough energy and subsidize it, China will beat us in it. So there's this incentive for the AI company. And you've seen some of them swing. Sam Altman didn't used to talk this way. Now he does. So the kind of China hawkism has acquired a whole new incentive as a result of the AI thing. Now, there are people in the field who are genuinely worried that if, you know, these are... There's some kind of sci-fi scenarios out there, which I don't totally dismiss, but they run like this. Like, they're pretty out there. Like, Once we get to so-called artificial general intelligence, next, then you will see this acceleration towards so-called superintelligence. And whoever gets to superintelligence first rules the world, not just because of the military applications, but because at that point you'll be so far ahead, because there will be such acceleration, you'll be so far ahead of any rivals that you can use AI in various ways to thwart their interests. I mean, that's the argument.
What is superintelligence, Bob?
Well, the first question is, what is artificial general intelligence? A term you hear a lot, AGI. By that, people mostly mean, you know, something on par with human intelligence in the full sense of the term. I mean, you know, already these large language models are, in a sense, you know, smarter than me by a long shot, but they can't do everything I do. They can't do all the jobs I could do. And I think most people by AGI mean, if you get to a point where you can just drop an AI into the job held by anybody with a desk job, at least, you know, maybe not plumbers yet, but anybody with a desk job, and it could do as good or better a job, then you've reached AGI. Now, the beyond that, they would say lies superintelligence. It's an intelligence, you know, far superior to human intelligence. It could outsmart us. It could persuade us to do anything. It's an inherently vague concept too, as, you know, as AGI kind of is. But the key premise is that once you kind of get to AGI, you get this takeoff. This is a long-standing view in certain circles, well, of science fiction, but
is
also—
Is there any historical parallel that one can cite of the phenomenon of takeoff?
We have seen accelerations in technological progress of various kinds, but what they would say is there's something new here, which is that the AI plays a direct role in its own improvement. I mean, it's already helping computer coders write code. And so if people at OpenAI are using it to do that, and they are, you can say, well, it's already accelerating AI a little. But the scenario, you know, this goes back to this notion of the singularity in, which was, it's been advanced by a few kind of futurist types. The idea has been that technological progress accelerates to a point, and the curve keeps getting steeper. And then at some point, you're at the singularity, and there are various conceptions of what that means, but that figures in the view of some of these people. So
does self-awareness have any role in this calculus? The program,
well, the question,
having consciousness, does consciousness, and
you know, it enters the debate, like, can AI have subjective experience? Is it sentient? You know, is it, I mean, my favorite formulation of the consciousness question is Thomas Nagel's. He said, you know, he wrote an essay called "What Is It Like to Be a Bat?" And part of the point was, if it's like anything to be a bat, then you could say bats have consciousness. You know, you and I would agree it is like something to be us, right? And the question is it like something to be an AI? I don't think we can rule out that it is already, and I'm not sure we would have a way of knowing with confidence when it was. I personally think that matters mainly on the ethical front. Like, you know, if they were experiencing pain and pleasure, then ethical questions about our treatment of them would arise. But in terms of their capabilities, I don't think the tremendous growth in capabilities depends on their being sentient, personally.
Okay, let's talk about foreign policy. I'm still wondering how the AI question intersects outside the context of competition with China. Yeah.
Well, I would just say I think it strengthens the case for trying to tamp down international tensions generally. I think within a few years we'll realize that AI is a sufficiently big international policy challenge that we really need to be focusing on it and can't afford to be distracted and divided by the things that have traditionally divided nations. That's my own view, but that's my main. I mean, it will enter into foreign relations in tons of ways. I mean, we are already, I mean, the U.S. national security state is like mobilizing around it almost. You know, I mean, this whole chip war on China, you know, these restrictions on the export of high-performance chips to China and chip-making equipment, you know, that's all part of a national security strategy. There was some Gulf state, I don't know if it was UAE or who, but they were, I guess, close to doing some kind of deal with a Chinese company to have, I guess, a data center with, you know, servers there that were powered by the abundant oil. And, you know, U.S. government got involved and like muscled China out and said, no, you're doing the deal with Microsoft, and made it in their interest to do the deal with Microsoft. I mean, this is already, it's entering into like, you know, strategic calculations in ways that I don't think are entirely rational, but they're becoming important. Mm.
So I gather that the demand for energy is an indirect implication of this technological development. That must be making the green people nervous.
Well, Silicon Valley used to be the green people, Glenn. That used to be almost the local religion. Like, that was the cult. I mean, Elon Musk, right? When he started making Teslas. And now, you know, and now they're not saying that so much because they want as much energy as possible. Now they're trying to say, well, we'll, you know, let's build nukes, which don't have carbon emissions, and let's, and we'll, you know, we'll throw in some green energy credits, you know, and so on. But I think, you know, as an economist, that in the near term, there's no way that you radically increase the amount of power consumption without increasing the amount of greenhouse gases, because you know, you just can't transition, you just can't accelerate the transition to green energy sources overnight.
I'm gonna change the subject a little bit. Trump got elected.
That is a change.
By a wide margin. And there's a new sheriff in town. On the foreign policy beat, you think that's going to, he says he's going to end the conflict in Ukraine on day one, or words to that effect. Much prospect of that being something other than bluster, in your view? He says he's got a plan for the Middle East. I mean, okay. Everybody's got a plan until you get hit in the face. Isn't that what Mike Watson said?
Mike Tyson, he did. And he's right. even if he didn't win his most recent fight, he's right. I think Trump even said he'd bring peace to Ukraine the day after the election somehow. I'm not sure. But anyway, you know, that's doable. I mean, people, including me, have been saying for some time that it was time for Biden to, you know, kind of push Ukraine toward the bargaining table and just accept the fact that you're going to have to leave some territory in Russian hands unless you want the war to go on so long that Ukraine gets completely destroyed. So it's doable. Biden has been reluctant to use the leverage he has with Ukraine, which of course is the fact that he was providing arms, and he's been reluctant to use that with Israel as well. But Trump, you know, you could use it. And I think Ukraine is coming to the recognition that the alternative to a highly imperfect peace may be destruction. So I think the environment's ripe for some kind of deal there.
Let me make sure I understand. You use the leverage through the ability to withhold weapons to Ukraine in order to induce them to get to the table, cede territory to Russia, and bring the hostilities to a close on terms that they otherwise, without our using our influence, wouldn't be inclined to accept. Is that the argument?
Yeah, I think the leverage is more important. What was it? 2 years ago, Mark Milley, chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, look, it's time to make peace. Things aren't going to get any better on the battlefield. He was right. And at that point, the Ukrainian public would have been very much against peace talks, I think. So the leverage, I think Biden would have had to say, look, I'm the bad cop. It's not Zelensky's fault, you know, and accept that role. I wrote a piece for Washington Post advocating exactly that after Milley weighed in. But now, you know, what Trump has said, I mean, he's got the game theory right. He has said, you know, he'd basically come up with a deal and say to Russia, if you don't accept it and Ukraine does, I'm going to give them 12 times as much weaponry as we've given them, and say to Ukraine, if you don't accept it and Russia does, I'm going to withdraw the weapons. Well, that is the incentive structure he's got in theory, right? He's got that right. And if he's willing to do that kind of thing, he can probably make it happen. A lot of challenges as far as what the details would be.
Aren't some hawks going to say you'd be appeasing a dictator that is Putin if you move in that direction? And that will only incentivize Putin to more aggressive behavior down the line.
Some will say that, not as many as would have said it a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, because, you know, it is clear and clearer that Ukraine is in trouble in the battlefield. But yeah, when you said this 2 years ago, I know from personal experience, you really just, I mean, literally would get accused of being, you know, some kind of Putin ally or selling out the Ukrainians or something. But now there are a number of people, there are people who said that about me, who are now advocating the same, saying now, okay, you're right. It is time to do peace talks. So I think, yeah, look, you're always going to get some blowback. There will always be hawks who don't like what you're doing. I suspect, though, that the argument will be more about the details of the deal than the fact of a deal at this point.
What are you making of the prospective nominees for top foreign policy and defense positions in the new administration?
Well, you know, as usual, Trump talks like a non-interventionist, but his appointments don't reflect that. Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, has traditionally been kind of a neocon. He's been talking on America First talk lately. I think much the same is true of the guy, I think it's Michael Waltz, who is the National Security Advisor.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the most troubling appointment is this guy, Pete Hegseth, as Secretary of Defense. I mean, it is fairly reliably documented. I mean, at least it was, you know, when back when he was running one of the two veterans organizations he ran, you know, a colleague filed a written report, as I understand it, saying, look, last night, you know, this guy got drunk at a bar or whatever and started chanting, kill all Muslims, okay, about Hegseth. And that's not getting much attention because there's so many other things that can get attention. I mean, he's been accused of sexual assault. He apparently, you know, they had to restrain him from joining strippers on the stage when he got, I mean, he just, there's a whole laundry list of things. And there's the fact, one of the things I find most troubling is, you know, he was an apologist for guys who were clearly war criminals. He convinced Trump to demand leniency for this guy, Eddie Gallagher, whose own comrades in arms said, look, this guy walked over. There was an 18-year-old prisoner of war who was being treated by a medic. This guy walked over and stabbed him while he was being treated by the medic. You know, he killed a prisoner of war. And his own fellow SEALs, these are Navy SEALs testifying to this, okay? This is not, you know, there's just no doubt that this guy is a very bad guy. And Hegseth was speaking up in his defense. And the idea of having a Secretary of Defense, right, who is known for forgiving war crimes, is just, it's a bad look. You know, my father was a career Army officer, so I grew up around the military. And I always had this very, I guess in retrospect, it seems idealistic, and maybe it was naive at the time. I don't know, but I had this idea that the Army was, they were professionals and they took their obligations seriously. My father certainly did. And so you bring in, you know, this guy who's an embarrassment on many levels and make him Secretary of Defense.
Why? What's the case for Hegseth?
The case is that you can't find four Republican senators who aren't afraid of Trump. I mean,
an answer to my question. Is Trump actually intending to appoint someone as evil, as awful, as inappropriate as you say, out of ignorance, out of malice, out of indifference? Or is there a quality that this guy brings to the position or a orientation or ideology that he brings to it that is finding favor with Trump? I'm just asking.
Yeah, and let me say, we may find four Republican senators who will stand up. That did happen with Matt Gaetz, so the jury's out. But as for Trump, you know, one thing you hear about him a lot is that when he's thinking about an appointment, I mean, this is what they said, but when he was considering Mitt Romney for Secretary of State last time around, he'll say he looks the part. And Mitt Romney did look the part. And I'm sure Trump, I think he tends to imagine how these people will look on camera, right? Like,
he's got a square jaw. He's a John Wayne type figure. You know, is that what you're saying?
Okay. Hey, he's an Ivy League jock. He played basketball for Princeton, I'm ashamed to say, because I went to Princeton. And he's a TV guy, right? He's a Fox News, you know, not correspondent, but whatever, you know, opinionizer, pundit, you know, and of course he sucked up to Trump on Fox. And so he's got the loyalty thing. You know, Trump doesn't have to worry about the loyalty. And so I guess it all adds up. And, you know, some of this stuff had not come out during the vetting. Trump didn't know about the sexual assault allegation and even all this other stuff about kill all Muslims. And I think most of that came out. Trump knew about the war criminal stuff because he responded positively to it at the time. But, you know, now I think now it's like, for Trump, he was wavering on Hegseth, I think. But then I think his people convinced him, like, hey, look, if we do this twice in a row, if he backs out the way Matt Gaetz did, we'll just look too weak. You got to stand behind him. So he's going to.
All right. Well, we'll see what's going to happen on that. What about the Middle East, Bob? What do you make of what's going on in Syria right now? It's a world historic, it feels to me. Mm-hmm. Rumblings of tectonic plates moving.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, Iran's position has been greatly weakened. Iran had this kind of axis of resistance thing going on with Hezbollah in particular. Now Hezbollah is decimated and the land bridge by which Iran got weapons to Hezbollah is no longer. I don't think there's much chance that under...
That's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how Israel uses the advantage. You know, I mean, if Israel would do what I wish they'd do and say, you know, I mean, if you look at what Israel would have described as its existential threat constantly facing it a year and a half ago, it's gone, right? I mean, you know, Israel is in a very strong position. And, you know, I would like them to recognize that whatever nuclear deal Iran wouldn't do last time around after Trump got out of the nuclear deal, they did do, they probably will do now. I mean, it just isn't hard through diplomatic means, I think, for Israel to get the, you know, the confident assurance that Iran's not building a nuclear weapon. You know, you can have a very intrusive inspection regime, monitoring regime. Iran is not in a position to strike a very hard bargain. If it turns out I'm wrong, fine, then I'm wrong. But what I worry is that Israel's not even going to explore that possibility. They're just going to try to take out the nuclear infrastructure, which isn't at the moment a weapons program, but it could become one in short notice.
I just heard John Mearsheimer tell somebody that they don't have Israel the capacity to take out Iran's nuclear program root and branch, that they need the United States in order to be able to accomplish that goal as a military objective.
That's what I've heard. I mean, Israel could do damage on its own, but I don't think, I mean, who knows? I don't think the Biden administration would give them the active U.S. military participation they'd need to do maximal damage. Trump might, who knows? Trump might. And so they may wait. I don't know what's going to happen, but I've heard the same thing you've heard.
Israel is at war with Iran, undeclared, but de facto. Is that not the case? The U.S. has a vital interest in seeing Israel prevail in that conflict with Iran, does it not? That's a question.
I don't think there has to be a conflict. I mean, I think in general our policy toward the Middle East has been really unfortunate. I don't think we've benefited from endlessly supplying Israel with weapons while they wreak much more destruction and death in Gaza than they had to for purpose of their own actual national security, in my view. I think that's bad for our national security. I mean, you know, if you look at the homegrown terrorism, as they called it, in between kind of 9/11 and recently, and by the way, I think without that, Trump might have never become president. If you look at like like when it happened and how he exploited it and so on. Those, you know, San Bernardino, the Pulse nightclub in Florida, whatever, just almost uniformly, the guys who did it said, here's why we're doing this. You know, it's not because you're a Christian nation. It's not that, but it's because your military is assaulting, is killing Muslims in a majority, in some majority Muslim nation somewhere. So, you know, when we supply Israel with the weapons that kill 45,000 Palestinians in Gaza, it could well come back to haunt us in that way. It could come back to haunt us in other ways. I certainly don't see it as doing us any good. And, you know, this is a case where Biden had the leverage to bring things to a close earlier, but for whatever reason, he didn't use it.
Well, how about this argument? The alternative to supporting Israel, providing those weapons, backing it in international forums and so on, is to watch the slow, inexorable, irresistible defeat of that project, the Israel project, the Zionist project. That would be a world historic setback for the West, for the United States in particular, and for Western civilization more broadly. Netanyahu was right when he came to Congress and he said, it's not a clash as Samuel Huntington would have had it between civilizations. What we have here is a conflict between civilization and barbarism. I think that's how he put it. The United States stands with our ally, our friend, the only liberal democracy in the region, in a very tough neighborhood, Israel. And that means, sometimes, when the shit hits the fan, supplying weapons, even when it might, in the short run, redound on the margins to some blowback that's unpleasant and so on. Yes, we know that. We live in a difficult world, but we have to make the choices that we have to make. The alternative to support is not supporting and watching Israel go down the drain. How's that as a good outcome?
I mean, first of all, I would say 36 hours after the October 7th attack, horrible as it was, Israel was secure again. Maybe I'm wrong, it's 48 hours. But, you know, and certainly, even if you, you know, I mean, they had rolled them back. They were caught totally unawares, okay? It was like a worst-case scenario, sleeping on the job, partly because part of the military was deployed, you know, helping settlers do what they do, and we can talk about that if you want. But, you know, totally caught by surprise, within 48 hours, totally under control. I mean, Hamas succeeded beyond anyone's wildest expectations militarily, but within 48 hours, totally under control. Not one guy still in Israel, okay? So if that's like the worst case, if that's when you're totally caught off guard, I just, you know, the fact is that by and large, Terrence had worked for Israel. And you know, if they want to argue that we had to really teach them a lesson after this one, well, I mean, how long does the lesson need to go on? I mean, you know, I was having I had Tom Friedman on my podcast, it was close to a year ago now, maybe not quite. And we were talking about, well, when can Bibi stop the war? And I said, you know, I guess if he kills this Sinwar guy, certainly he can declare victory then. And Tom said, well, there's also this Mohammed Daif guy, or whatever his name is, who runs the military Hamas. And we were both assuming that, well, if he could just do that, I mean, he could just have a festival in his honor. It would be so obvious he had vanquished his foe. Well, he's now killed them both, and he's still killing people in Gaza. I mean, this is so far beyond. I mean, it isn't just beyond what their national security needs demand. I think it's moving in the opposite direction. You know, there are so many embittered people in Gaza, and this was happening from the beginning. I mean, look, 1 in 50 people in Gaza has been killed. More than that actually. And in terms of maimed, permanently wounded, if you want to killed and maimed, wounded, it's probably 1 in 20. So basically, everyone in Gaza is related to one of these people. Okay, and you just don't forget that. So if they think this is the way you put an end to all terrorism, we'll see. But I don't think, you know, I mean, I've long thought that the policies favored by so-called pro-Israel camps are often not really good even for Israel, much less for the U.S.
Well, I mean, let me go on the record saying I have more than a little bit of sympathy for the concerns that you've expressed about the humanitarian disaster which the Israel war in Gaza is prosecuting. I've said as much. I've been in argument with my friend and colleague John McWhorter here at the Glenn Show about that very subject. I published at the Substack that I maintain in a little small essay setting out my concerns. But I have to tell you, I don't think I've ever encountered as much anger and accusations of bigotry and anti-Semitism directed at me as I have and as I am getting for an occasional expression of anguish about tens of thousands of dead civilians in Gaza and about my government's complicity in the killing.
Yeah.
You've been criticizing U.S. foreign policy for many years, Bob, and you know the territory a lot better than I do in terms of talking about Palestine. When I wonder how those conversations went when you were at the New Republic, the quarter century ago.
That's where it all started.
What's up with that, man? I mean, let me just say this. There are other sides of this argument from the one that you just presented. There are people who are very strongly supportive of Israel's prosecution of the war in Gaza, and they have their reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I can't understand. What I can't understand is why there isn't open, robust, and vigorous debate within our councils of political deliberation and in our media about these questions, more so than there actually is. It seems to me that there's a lid on the discussion, that there's certain acceptable opinions that get conventionally expressed, and then there's certain, it's partitioned, especially with the new media now, with everybody having their own little corner of the internet where they can talk. But the blob, there is a thing called the blob. Is that, I mean, a kind of established, I mean, they seem impervious to the debate. And I don't understand that at all. Do you?
Preach it, Glenn. I just retweeted somebody on Twitter who's saying blobs, what is it? Blobsplain should become a term. It's like mansplaining, except it's when the people in foreign policy establishment talk to you as if you don't understand the, you know, the harsh realities of blah, blah, blah. Yeah, no, look, first of all, the people in Israel and pro-Israel people are sincere in their beliefs, I think. And I will say, look, Israel is in, a more precarious position than the U.S. And if you saw how we overreacted, I thought, to 9/11, you know, I opposed the invasion of Iraq. I thought at the time we were overreacting, but we did it. People freak out. And I would say that Israel, it's not necessarily the case that I think they are responding any more irrationally relative to the threat they face than we were responding irrationally relative to the threat we faced. I just think both of us are wrong and are overreacting, but I don't doubt the sincerity of people in Israel. Now, back to your question, yeah, there's a speech code. There was also one on Russia-Ukraine, you know, getting accused of spreading Putin talking points, right? Like, yeah. if you said, look, which was my position, look, the invasion was illegal. He deserves blame for that. But I think it took some pretty unwise U.S. foreign policy for us to get to this point and blah, blah, blah. And with Israel, there's a particularly strong speech code enforcement. I will say the Overton window is expanding. I mean, you know, Jimmy Carter wrote a book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, I don't know, 15 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even saying it was already apartheid, and he certainly wasn't saying Israel proper or the state was apartheid. He was just saying, this is where you're headed. He had to apologize and walk it back. I mean, yeah. He got major blowback from the Anti-Defamation League, which, I mean, I'll be frank, is one of the enforcers of the speech code. That's one thing the ADL does, is they enforce the pro-Israel speech code. The executive director said something about something I wrote once, so I know I have some personal experience. So yeah, there's a speech code. I mean, there often is, you know, when people feel strongly about things, it could be the trans issue. You know, there's always this dimension of kind of name-calling that can have the effect of stifling debate. And this, you're right, this is has been a particularly strongly enforced speech code. There's more room than there used to be. And also there are real anti-Semites. I mean, you know, who criticize Israel, you know, it's not entirely an hallucination, but yeah, I think the term is used too broadly. And I think, you know, we saw some of this with the campus demonstrations. I'm sure there were some anti-Semites on campus, but I think the allegation was used to some extent as a way to shut down pro-Palestinian speech.
Transparently, in my view, a lot of the speech code policing is about a contestation over moral legitimacy and an attempt to prevent a consensus emerging of more condemnation of Israel in various dimensions. I mean, use of the word apartheid. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not trying to pick a fight with anybody. I think I know what people mean when they say that in reference, for example, to the occupied territories in the West Bank and so on. Mm-hmm. No, it's not South Africa circa 1960 or something like that. It's the West Bank of the Jordan River circa 2024. That's what it is. And it has apartheid-like characteristics, and we could go into them. Mm-hmm. But that's not, you know, people aren't interested in parsing the minute details. They're interested in controlling the tone of the discourse. Likewise with the word genocide. Right. You have international bodies, you know, the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court or whatever. They issue indictments, they issue declarations, and you have human rights organizations, that's some of them, Human Rights Watch, et cetera. They issue reports, analyses, there's so forth and so on. And there's an objective debate, but that's not really what the argument is about. The argument is about, don't you, if we, I mean, people say the following, they say this incredibly, and it befuddles me. They say, if Israel wanted to kill them all, they would already been dead because it has the capacity to do so. So it can't be genocide. How is that an argument? You didn't kill them all and therefore you didn't cross a line. I mean, so, anyway, I will desist. The argument here, it seems to me, it's going on at a meta level. There's the objective assessment, apartheid, genocide, ethnic cleansing. You know, Ilan Pape wrote this book. I actually thought it was a pretty good book when I read it 15 years ago or whatever. The ethnic cleansing in Palestine about the history of the Nakba and so on. Plan Dalit and all of that kind of stuff. But ethnic cleansing, John Mearsheimer says that the ultimate goal, the reason why this war persists, the reason why every a habitable structure practically within stone's throw of a potential Hamas militant is being leveled and turned into rubble because they're trying to make the area untenable because they want the people out.
I mean, of those terms, you know, I'm not ready to apply apartheid to Israel proper. Some people do. Those reports from Human Rights Watch that said they did. There is some institutionalized discrimination against Palestinians within Israel proper, but I would not personally apply that word. Right. I haven't even used the word genocide because I just have always used that word conservatively. But ethnic cleansing is happening in the West Bank for starters, and more than ever over the last year. And you know, and this gets and look, there's some kind of war crimes being committed in Gaza, whatever you want to call it, you know, forced relocation, which is kind of the almost a formal legal equivalent of what's kind of colloquially called ethnic cleansing. But yeah, there seems to be an attempt to clear out at a minimum kind of northern Gaza, and I'm not sure that under Trump they wouldn't manage to clear out a lot more of Gaza. I mean, I think he would be pretty tolerant of that. But you know, it gets back to Carter warning them, like, you know, you're headed toward apartheid, and Carter getting shouted down with name calling, and then so Israel to that extent being insulated from criticism, that was in retrospect I would say constructive, because look at where they are. I mean, the West Bank is more like apartheid than it was then. There is much more manifest ethnic cleansing on the West Bank than there was then, and it gets back to you know, citing that kind of standard defense. But what about this beacon of liberal democracy in the Middle East? Well, is that what you'd call it? I mean, even if Israel proper can still be called a liberal democracy, and there are more and more threats to, you know, truly liberal values even within Israel proper. I mean, you know, the behavior of the settlers, as sometimes defended by the military, sometimes even abetted by the military, is just something no decent person should want to be associated with. You know, the United States should not want its name associated with that. And we have not been doing Israel a favor by insulating it from the kind of criticism that might have moderated its behavior at some point. I don't know.
Okay. Well, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a book, The Message. I don't know if you've read it. I've read it.
I haven't read it.
I had some positive things to say about it. That's cost me some friends.
That's a shame. Not that you said positive things, but that you had to lose friends over it. I mean, that's a shame.
Now, what I'm trying to say here is there's another side to this argument, and that side begins with its Palestinian terror, recalcitrance, determination to, from the river to the sea, rid the land of Jews, this kind of talk, this kind of thought. The reason that you have checkpoints and restricted access to roads and fences and other security measures is because people were blowing up buses, blowing themselves up in cafes, because mm-hmm. the Palestinian Authority was rewarding families of quote-unquote martyrs who had committed these heinous acts, and because the charter of the Hamas commits the organization to the destruction of the Jewish state. As such, this is an abomination. This is not something that you can split the difference with. This is life or death. The measures that you see, as ugly and problematic as they may be, are nevertheless the necessary response to Islamic terror and to the lack of interest of the Palestinian movement in a peaceful resolution of these conflicts and disputes. And that's not saying anything positive about the excesses of the settlers. We, of course, condemn the excesses of the settlers, but we're dealing with we've got a tiger by the tail here. We're not going to let go.
Yeah, and I think somebody like Sinwar probably, you know, does have the aspiration of, or did, turning all of Israel into an Islamist state. I mean, I doubt he had the aspiration of killing all the Jews, but an aspiration that is incompatible with Israel's interest, to put it mildly. There are people like that. There have been. I do think we, meaning the U.S. and Israel, have repeatedly failed, and sometimes I think really intentionally, to pick up on opportunities to cultivate moderate elements within groups like Hamas. I would encourage people, I wrote a piece called The Truth About Hamas in my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, and it recounts an opportunity that we had, oh gosh, it's now been about 15 years, with Hamas, where Hamas, you know, the officials of Hamas were saying, okay, we're ready to talk about a two-state solution. And a lot of other things were in play, very fluid moment. It's pretty clear that somebody didn't want that to happen. I think maybe including Bibi Netanyahu at the time, if I'm recalling that detail correctly. But I'd encourage people to Google that and take a look. You know, I think in general, there's been this narrative on our side, I mean, meaning the U.S. and the Israel side, that all of the missed opportunities were missed by Palestinians. And I just think that's a very slanted narrative. I think both sides have missed opportunities. I mean, a piece I wrote in Slate like forever ago called Was Arafat the Problem, which is still there, was about the conventional wisdom that he is the only one to blame for the failure of the Camp David talks. And I think you can, it's not hard to show that that has been misrepresented. So, you know, I mean, yeah, you're right. There are people who want to kill everybody in Israel, and there are Israelis who want to kill everybody in Palestine. Let's don't delude ourselves. But have there been opportunities to cultivate political elements that could have led to a very different present? I think there have been, personally. And again, I think adopting the kind of official Israeli narrative that all missed opportunities have been Palestinian just makes it easier for Israel to keep missing opportunities. There's you know, there's no pressure on them, kind of.
Why would the United States of America follow a policy with respect to this conflict that is, in your telling, manifestly not in the interest either of our client or of ourselves? I mean, the question may seem obvious, but I invite your response nonetheless.
Sounds a little like a rhetorical question, Glenn. I almost think you could answer it. Maybe I'll ask it and you can answer it. No, I mean, Look, obviously, there are various pro-Israel actors in America have some political power. There's AIPAC, which is itself strong. There are pro-Israel think tanks like the Foundation for Defense of Democracies that are very good at what they do. I mean, they have this symbiotic relationship with New York Times reporters, you know, like they provide them with good information and they get favorably quoted and whatever. And then, of course, the Republicans have the evangelical Christian base, which, you know,
encourage pro-Zionist.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, foreign policy. The thing about foreign policy is because most Americans don't care that much about it until body bags start coming home. You know, it's very susceptible to influence by relatively small special interest groups, you know. So, and there are a bunch of, I mean, the Cuba lobby in Florida has maintained this completely irrational policy of sanctions on Cuba for forever. You know, if we had never sanctioned them, they would be the 51st state by now, I think, you know. And there are plenty of examples. You know, the original expansion of NATO was done partly to get votes of Midwestern Americans of East European heritage. Clinton was interested in getting, you know, Polish American votes and so on in wherever, I don't know, Illinois or somewhere. And then there's always the arms lobby in, you know, which played a big role in NATO expansion, plays a big role now in our foreign policy. And to get back to something earlier, is playing a big role in convincing us that we're in a kind of death struggle with China.
I ask you to put on your prognosticator's hat here and speculate about what Palestine looks like in 20 years. Where's this headed?
Man, I don't know. I guess an alarming, an unsettling thing is that Israel seems not that far from indifferent to how they're viewed. And you know, because I think the Israeli view is we're always going to face these threats from all these people who hate us. So we shouldn't spend time trying to make them like us. We should just make sure they're too weak to hurt us. That's why they're bombing stuff in Syria now. You know, even though ostensibly you're going to have a new regime that I think could easily be muscled into being a good neighbor to Israel, given the outside players who have influence on the new regime in Syria. But Israel's not going to take the chance. They're blowing up all the weapons, and I guess that's what worries me in terms of...
They're defanging Hezbollah and in a way putting to rest the knotty problem that they had on the northern border, and the opportunity to do that comes once in a lifetime. I'm channeling Bibi now. You don't let that come and go without taking advantage of it. We're going to act while we can definitively against whomever we need to act in order to make sure that they don't accumulate those weapons and those missiles don't threaten Tel Aviv and Haifa and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at what point, what would it take to make them feel secure? I mean, you know, the land bridge is severed. Iran cannot resupply Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been decimated, okay?
This is the nail in the coffin, and we're going to drive it in.
But why do they have to? I'm telling you, there is a nuclear deal that's gettable, I think, with Iran. But look, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But why don't you try it out before you start a war with Iran? Because look, I'm telling you, if you hit Iran's nuclear infrastructure, you're going to see a lot of ballistic missiles flying from Iran to Israel. And that's not good for various reasons, including the fact that, who knows, they could be aimed at Israel's nuclear reactor.
Is the international community, and I use the words advisedly, completely impotent in the face of this conflict? Is it really all coming down to whether or not and to what extent the United States does or does not exert influence on its client to pull back from the brink?
Yeah, I mean, because the U.S. has the leverage. The U.S. is supplying the weapons. And, you know, the U.S. also supplies the cover at the UN, like we'll veto the resolutions usually to call the settlements illegal or whatever. But I don't really think in the end Israel, that matters very much. I mean, because as I said, it seems increasingly Israel just thinks that. And I think they genuinely think that people hate them without reason. And it's always going to be that way. And So that's life. So it's you know, I mean, the UN resolutions in and of themselves don't have teeth unless they lead to sanctions or some kind of authorized military intervention. And anyway, I mean, the U.S. vetoes the ones that don't have teeth anyway, if they're adverse to Israel as a rule. So, yeah, no, I think the main, barring some kind of international economic boycott, you know, organized by, I don't know who, maybe, you know, European nations or something, I think it's largely about the weapons the U.S. supplies. I mean, that's real leverage.
Okay. Well, I've exhausted my quiver of questions, Bob. I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
Oh, I like, we should leave people on a more positive note than this. I mean, I do think the thing in Syria is potentially stabilizing, potentially good for the Syrian people. You know, and it gets back to my view about people generally. It's like, I have kind of a cynical view about people is that in the end, most of them are going to do what people are ideologically flexible in the end, I think, if you can make it in their interest to be that. And I personally suspect that this guy who's running the show in Syria now, the head of HTS, is going to prove that he's fairly pragmatic and flexible and is not going to suddenly impose draconian Islamist rule that persecutes religious minorities and so on, as some people still fear. So, and I just wish the U.S. would work hard to get Israel to take advantage of what could be a stabilizing opportunity.
Likewise for Ukraine, I gather.
There's an opportunity.
That is, you wish that the U.S. would use its influence to influence the Ukrainians to get to the bargaining table.
Yeah, and I suspect that war will be over within a year. I mean, it may just be called a ceasefire, but you know, things don't get out of hand before then. If there's not radical escalation, I think that will be the case. You know, I would just encourage people. I mean, you know, you had said we might talk about cognitive empathy. I guess that'll have to wait for another day. But, you know, that's just this business of putting yourself in the shoes of other people, not for purposes of sympathizing with them or feeling their pain. That's emotional empathy. But I would encourage people just exercise, just try to understand the perspectives of people around the world. And I hope that'll make people a little more reluctant to just immediately align themselves with one tribe or another in a lot of conflicts and thereby be able to be a more constructive force. You know, and that includes their own politics. I mean,
well, that goes both ways, right? There are always, everybody has got a story and we should try to understand their story, put ourselves in their shoes. You do that for the Israelis as well as for the Palestinians, I presume.
I mean, as I said, Israel is in a uniquely, you know, none of us are in the situation that Israel is in. You know, the U.S. has never felt nearly as violated as Israel felt during the Second Intifada. We don't know what that's like. And judging by the way we reacted in 9/11, as I said, we would react very dramatically to that. That doesn't mean that the dramatic reaction would be in our interest.
I was just going to say, excuse me, cognitive empathy is something I see easily at the level of an individual person processing the information and thinking about what they can and can't understand. Less easy to see how it affects the institutional response, the governments, states, actions, and so on. The blob, the mechanisms that intermediate between individual sympathies on the one hand and the policies of governments on the other. Try that with AIPAC, cognitive empathy, see how far you get.
Before I get to AIPAC, let me just say, as far as the blob goes, if the blob had been better at cognitive empathy in the sense of understanding how the last 25 years of U.S. foreign policy toward Russia would be perceived in Russia and by Putin, I think we would have behaved differently because we would have recognized that it was in our interest to behave differently. You know, I mean, one of the main virtues of cognitive empathy can be to play a non-zero-sum game to a win-win outcome because you understand the other player's perspective better, or at least not wind up in a lose-lose outcome. You know, AIPAC, I think it doesn't hurt to understand that, you know, I think most of the people there are sincerely motivated. Some of them identify strongly with Israel, think it is existentially threatened. And, you know, I encourage people to, I, I, I suspect that's the case. And it doesn't hurt even, you know, even if you consider yourself an enemy of AIPAC. But one thing I do try to work against, even on, quote, my side of foreign policy debates, is the demonization of, you know, the idea that everyone on the other side is evil and they know they're doing evil. I think very few people think of themselves as doing evil. But by the way, speaking of the speech code, what actor was it who said he was making that point, and it's a valid point? And he said, I think even Hitler didn't get up every day and think, I'm going to see how much evil I can do. And he had to apologize because that was called anti-Semitic. But I think, you know, whatever you think of Hitler, I think it's an important point that almost everyone thinks they're doing good, you know, and you have to understand that. Almost everybody on both sides of all conflicts thinks they're not just doing good for themselves, but they're in the right morally. Don't you think that's the case? Isn't that your experience?
Yeah, I don't think people want to think of themselves as being evil or find a lot of satisfaction in imagining themselves to be doing evil. I think, however, that there are standards, objective standards by which we can distinguish between good and evil. And that many of the people who think of themselves not as evil are, in fact, objectively evil.
No, I think there are people on the side of wrong and the people on the side of right. But I do think the best way to reduce the amount of wrong in the world, the amount of bad, the amount of violence and suffering, is to recognize that the people you're dealing with, the players whose behavior you're trying to influence, think they're doing good. That's the psychology at play.
That's going to meet with some pushback, I think. I mean, while you're thinking about what they're thinking, they're actually blowing your head off.
Well, look, there's times when you just have to react, obviously.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
All right, Bob. Again, thanks for your time. Bob Wright, Non-Zero Foundation, a wise man. We're going to get into trouble for this conversation, but then we were already in trouble before we started, so...
No, I think as long as I've got you to stand up for me, I feel secure about this one. You know, sometimes I end one of these conversations, I go, oh shit, I'm in trouble. But now I know I've got Glenn on my side. I'm sure you'll have my back.
We'll see what we can do.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thank you.